judgment calls. We could certainly work to provide examples and guidance of what would be in or out of those as examples if they were adopted into the statute, to provide some policy guidance to practitioners around the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, is she referring to where it says no person shall subject the blood of an individual to an HIV test?
Right, section 17 of the amended per.
Yeah, section three.
Yeah.
Subsection.
No, I think I've got the.
Three, A through E.
A through E.
Lines 20 through the end of page one.
And line 22 to line three on the next page could be put in after line nine of the new section 17, I think. Undoes what the OMA had asked us to try to do, which was to get that kind of specific out of the bill.
Gina, Scott, you're indicating that under some circumstances, a physician can, could make these tests anyway?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is my understanding of case law and common law in regard to emergency circumstances. And I need to emphasize again that if in fact you start to place into statute exceptions, then you're going to create probably the opposite effect, in my opinion, that you want to create.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ford.
I'd like to ask Stevie for her legal interpretation on that.
I don't think Ms. Remington.
I would love to do it.
No, but from the viewpoint of the ACLU.
All right, right, Stevie?
That's right, and Ted Falk is here and is knowledgeable on that, and I would defer to him for those responses.
Okay, Ted, would you want to come on up?
All the chairs attached here. Take mine.
All these chairs.
There's one over the end.
My name is Ted Falk, and I did participate in the group that was drafting these amendments. First of all, I think that it's correct that in informed consent in other situations, there are a variety of exceptions under common law that would permit there to be no informed consent, for example, in a medical emergency. But it should be remembered that informed consent in those other situations is itself a common law requirement. There is no statute which requires informed consent. There is a statute which for physicians specifies the procedure by which informed consent will be obtained. There is no informed consent statute for any other healthcare practitioner, and the basic requirement even for physicians is a common law requirement, and therefore it has common law exceptions. And I think that the chairman is quite correct that the new version of the informed consent requirement as it's written here is absolute on its terms, and there would not be, I believe, the opportunity for common law exceptions as it's been written. Now, I think there are three approaches that one might take to amending the bill to put back in some possibility of exceptions along the lines that you've been talking. One would be an enumerated list of exceptions, and that's the way the original amendments were drafted. A second possibility would be to give the health division the power to write rules for exceptions. And the third possibility would be to say something along the lines of except in situations where informed consent would not be required under the law of this state. That last approach might be preferable except for the fact that it's very unclear whether the existing law of this state would or would not require informed consent in this situation. It's sort of a new frontier of informed consent law, and I don't think one can say with any confidence whether or not the common law does impose a requirement of informed consent. I appreciate Mr. Gallen's concern for not wanting to clutter up the law in this area with a lot of elaborate exceptions and counter-exceptions so that it becomes difficult to know how to comply with it. But I'm not really sure of a satisfactory method for building in those exceptions except by enumerating them as was done in the previous draft. I'll also mention that the model statute, which was prepared, which Stevie Remington has a copy of, which was prepared by the National Civil Liberties Organization, which unfortunately we did not have it in hand when we were drafting these amendments originally, has an even longer list of exceptions, and a lot of them look sort of reasonable. But I think as the bill is drafted, it wouldn't, I don't think it would have permitted the healthcare worker to get consent in the situation you've described. Now, I think in practice, the importance of those exceptions is probably not very great. Healthcare workers, as I understand it, are being instructed to take the sort of precautions on every patient that would be required on the assumption that that patient did have HIV infection. And so although it is of some psychological importance for the healthcare worker, it's not of a great deal of practical importance in terms of how they manage patients on an everyday basis. I mean, if you've been to a dentist recently, I hope your dentist is using rubber gloves, and that's just a standard precaution that's being taken now. So I don't think that these, whether or not we have these exceptions, is going to make a great deal of difference in terms of the everyday realities of healthcare. But I think it would be necessary to build in the exceptions if you felt it was important to allow the opportunity for HIV testing without consent in the sort of situations you've described.
Mr. Chairman, my very point was just made a minute ago in that there is an even longer list of exceptions in the other document, whatever they are, and therefore there is probably an even longer list than that. You will literally place the provider in a circumstance of not knowing when or if or whether they should or should not give informed consent. And the point is that if in fact the provider in his or her best judgment makes a determination that there is in fact a medical emergency, then they'll act, and I believe that they'll be protected by the current case and common law that they're working under now. But once you begin to illuminate in statute this sort of thing, there will never be an end to it, and you'll in fact hamper the health care provider more than in fact help the certain circumstances that you're concerned about.
I guess I've got to ask even a more basic question here to make sure that I understand it. Now, when a person goes for an operation, or his doctor indicates to him, you know, going to have an operation, I can understand the necessity for the doctor to explain to the patient the risks of the operation and all of that. I guess I'm just a little unclear as to why informed consent is so important in terms of testing the blood of an individual. I guess that's a basic question. Christy, do you want to?
I'll tackle it. I'm not sure I can fully explain it to your satisfaction. First of all, I think you need to understand that there is a large body of opinion that says informed consent, clear informed consent, ought to be given for any procedure that's going to be done on you. That it really isn't appropriate for a physician to just say, stick out your arm, I want to draw some blood, we're going to find out what's wrong with you, and not tell you that they're going to be running tests for anemia and tests for cancer or tests for whatever. That the sort of blanket, trust me, let me do what I need to on you, is an outdated approach to healthcare practices. And so there's quite a large body of thinking that suggests that a fairly explicit informed consent ought to happen for any procedures and so people know what they're getting into and what they may learn from them. With particular regard to the HIV test, that emerges out of concerns of, again, a very wide range of people who sat around the table in that policy committee, practitioners of medicine and other health professions, citizens at large in the community, who said, this particular test has some unusual things attached to it. People ought to know before it's done that they may learn something here. they may have to start asking some questions about their spouse's sexual activity, about previous transfusions they had, and that a finding of a positive HIV test isn't just like a finding that your red blood count's a little bit low, because it's going to tell you some things about exposure that you may have not wanted to think about, that people need to know that going into the test. Secondly, that having that test recorded in a document in today's world exposes you to some interesting assumptions about you. Assumptions that can in fact be devastating, because in many cases seeing a positive HIV test on a man's chart leads to the immediate assumption that that man is gay. Seeing that assumption on a woman's chart leads to an immediate assumption that that woman must be a drug user or a prostitute or both. And many people don't really want that written down anywhere. Even if the assumption is wrong about them, they don't necessarily wish to get into a situation where such a fact might be recorded about them. And therefore, the policy committee felt quite strongly that persons prior to this test being done on them had a right to know what kind of information is revealed by the test and what that might mean for them, and to make a decision about having that test done. And that's why it was written here. I think a number of the people on the committee would have just as soon written a statute that says no person shall subject the blood of an individual to any known medical test without advance informed consent. But they understood that that is something that a lot of people wouldn't go for at all. So they did it for this one test because of their very strong feelings about it.
The results of the test are not on the front page of the Oregonian. You know, so I'm kind of, what do you mean?
Yeah. A test.
Who's going to find out if it's in? Who has access to a patient's chart?
Have you been at a hospital and seen how many people have access to the charts that are there? Not all of whom have a real need to know the details, but who can pick them up and read them. I can tell you anecdotally about a case in Oregon in which a person who was HIV positive was brought to a hospital. That person rightly informed the providers on both the emergency transport vehicle and in the emergency room of a positive HIV test. By the time the person attempted to return to work 48 hours later, that person's employer had been told that that person was HIV positive. This one is a hot topic. And despite our cautions and our intentions that healthcare records are private, the word moves around. In addition, there are many instances in which you are asked to consent to your whole healthcare record being forwarded to an insurance company, to an employer, because they're involved with a right to return to work. And you don't say, I want everything but page 28 of my chart returned over to my insurance company. If it's down there, it goes along with the rest of the chart.
Because it couldn't have been dealt with in a, you know, by perhaps changing the statutes in terms of confidentiality and where such information is put on a patient's chart, and could have been dealt with that way rather than, you know, this approach. Okay.
We have the non-disclosure language in Section 3 at the top of page 16. And if, in fact, you are unable to agree with our proposal with regard to the informed consent, I certainly hope you will be able to support our proposal with regard to non-disclosure of these test results, which puts very firm language in for non-disclosure.
I'd like to turn to other members of the committee. I mean, do you have a concern about this area or not?
I guess I have a concern less for the healthcare worker who presumably is trained, you know, to protect him or herself, and if they don't, then, you know, they are at fault. I'm more of a concern about an innocent person who receives an involuntary contact of some kind. The issue of rape was raised. There may be other means by which a person receives an involuntary contact with an HIV positive person, and I'm concerned that that person, the way the thing is written now, would have to go to this person from whom the contact was made under perhaps unusual circumstances and ask for informed consent in order to find out whether he or she has been exposed. I guess I have a greater concern there than I do for the healthcare worker.
Well, I think that was the kind of thing we were attempting to cover in that first line of exceptions that was in the original version of the statute.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I have to say, I really don't understand the legal sensitivities. I've listened carefully and tried to. And yet, if, as Christine has pointed out, if you look at those exceptions originally on the first amendments, I guess the amendments dated April 22nd anyway.
Yes.
Where you talk about bypassing informed consent if a person is, four possibilities, maybe there's five possibilities. You see, and I look at item C where it says failure to test could reasonably be expected to pose a serious threat to another individual. I think that that may very well relate to, somewhat relate, of course, pose a serious threat. The serious threat has already taken place.
Mr. Chairman,
take it back.
And I would like to return, I guess, with a rhetorical question. If the representative could define for me what a reasonable threat is, given the circumstance, particularly with AIDS, where the medical community is learning more and more and more about it, you are in fact placing the provider in a circumstance of trying to figure out what a reasonable serious threat is.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well,
and I don't think you can actually say in today's climate, in fact, what that is.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may respond to that. Again, I'm not a lawyer, but it would seem to me that the term reasonable just means that. It's not defined. It's a matter of personal judgment as to what's reasonable. And as long as the person making the decision behaved in a prudent and judicious manner and exercised what appeared to be reasonable judgment at the time, I would tend to believe that he should not be falsely accused of being unreasonable.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Agron,
yeah.
An individual goes into a physician's office and asks for a test and is in fact found to be HIV positive. He is required to keep that information confidential. Okay? He goes back and in fact turns out to be communicable. The physician is still required to keep that information confidential. He is not running around causing harm to people, but around his friends he cuts himself or somehow infects someone else. Does that individual have, in fact, a cause of action because the physician knew that there was a possibility for serious harm, i.e. infection of another individual who gets the disease? I don't know. And while that sounds like a rather far out way to go, if I were a clever attorney, I certainly would consider trying to give it a whirl, in this circumstance. And I can't emphasize enough that you're going to miss things in here, or you're going to create vague, standards that you're going to place people in extremely difficult positions of trying to deal with what is a very frightening and difficult disease to deal with.
If I may, I think you switched gears on us there, because the issue there is the failure to warn another where the physician already knew, and that we're getting around with making the positive test reportable. And the physician has done his duty to warn or her duty to warn by reporting it to the health agency, which then has to deal with how to protect others in the community.
Okay, let me make sure I'm clear on that, Christy. Any physician who has a patient that is tested and shows up HIV positive needs to be reported to the health division.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Those rules have not been adopted as of today, but we have a clear outline of those rules from the HIV policy report, and we are proceeding.
But that's not in this bill, though.
That is not in the bill, because we don't need any statutory language to do that. We're doing that under existing statute to make infectious conditions reportable. And we will make that positive test reportable, and we will have in that reportability assurances and follow-ups to make certain that that HIV-positive person gets educated, has an opportunity to refer contacts, all of those things that go with public health behavior. What we're dealing with here, the examples we've been talking about, is where the person's infectious status isn't known, and they expose someone else to their blood, and you're making decisions about whether or not they need to be tested to see whether they've put people at risk. And that's a judgment call if the person says, you can't test my blood. I mean, I think the first try ought to be to talk to that person and see. And in most cases, people who have put others at risk and are interested will give consent. We're talking about the small percentage where the person holds out and says, no, I don't want my blood tested, but you've got another person who's had an extensive exposure to the blood and you're concerned about it. We were trying to account for that in the first version of this, and the OMA people have been very reluctant to see that in the statute because they feel that the physicians are going to have a hard time making those judgment calls, that it exposes them to risks and threats. And I suppose one of the possibilities would be to, if you adopted something like this, would be to put in a double check after consultation with a public health authority or something like that, so that that physician didn't feel like he or she were having to make that decision all by themselves with no support and protection for having made the right or wrong decision. I'm trying to be sensitive to both your concerns that we have a way to test where we see an issue, and the concern that really triggered this whole rewrite, which was the OMA's concern about physicians in the field.
Representative Van Loon, question.
I had several questions, but Christine's just brought up another one. You say that you don't need a law as far as the rules you're thinking about putting in, but how come you haven't already proposed them?
The policy guidance for those rules just came out in late February. We have been meeting with the people involved. We've been putting into place so many different things around this particular infection that particular packet of rules just hasn't gotten there yet. It's a matter of deciding that we needed to get the education program up and running before we sat down and did that rule writing. It was priority setting. But I'm sure they will be in place well before the end of this calendar year, and I'm certain much earlier than that.
Okay, then back to this particular bill. In section 17, if we don't go back to the A engrossed, I guess that was the A engrossed version, what would be wrong with, I'm just talking about it now because we have not had a chance to look at these amendments until just now, what would be wrong with amending the new section 17 to saying that no person shall subject the blood of an individual to an HIV test without notification, period. And then, if necessary, and I didn't understand all of what was going on here, then you were talking about the possibility of a hospital and so forth and all of the records being available to so many people. Why not change the rules so that in those suspected cases, the blood sample is not sent in as from Liz Van Leeuwen, but it's sent in with a number on it that doesn't identify whomever the sample was taken from, so that those things can be done not as a public record to all of the nurses and aides and whatever you have that might be seeing it.
Well, we've tried to address the confidentiality, as I said, at the top of page 16 with the non-disclosure, and we do now have a provision for coding lab tests as they go through the system, but at some point you need to keep a record that matches that specimen back up, particularly if you're doing the test to deal with an emergency situation where multiple people were exposed, where somebody was exposed, because one of the reasons for doing it is to deal with the potential liabilities or the comfort level, the potential exposures of individuals, and I think anybody involved in that situation would want a clear document of what they did and didn't test if they had finally decided to do it. So I would be very reluctant to set up a system where no record would ever reappear that the test was done on you.
No, that's not, Mr. Chair.
As a practical matter, all patients who are undergoing surgery, as I understand it, are in fact being tested, first of all, and they're giving consent for that to be done, and secondarily, the blood that is used that is necessary for surgery is also tested as well. So you in fact have already a process that is in operation to deal with that surgery.
Okay, but you took it into the hospital realm a while ago in what you were talking about.
You probably have more of a problem in an emergency circumstance where someone has been in an automobile accident, for example, where you are dealing, in fact, in an emergency circumstance where you may be doing that test, but you don't have any other option but to deal with that individual immediately in order to deal with that person's life in that process. So. You wouldn't get informed consent from that individual to begin with.
Okay, but let's take it back, Mr. Chair, to the situation where the person is ill and goes to the doctor and then does not give consent to the doctor to perform a blood test, even though the doctor suspects.
The doctor, in that case, I presume, would be telling that patient, this is one of the tests we really ought to do on you. Your symptoms such we need to do it, or we have some reason. And if you don't consent to having it done and we don't do it, there'll be a missing piece of information in your file. That's a part of the negotiation around a diagnostic workup that I think goes on with doctors now if a patient declines to have a certain x-ray done or declines to have a certain test done. I think, again, the instance in which we're talking about isn't that kind of individual care negotiation with a physician. It's where there's been some unusual circumstance that exposes a third party or perhaps even the provider in an unanticipated way that we're trying to talk through how you would get to the test, protecting the interests of all the parties involved.
But according to the new language, if the person refused the test and they were positive, you've just cut off the possibility of the protection for anyone else as I read this bill.
Again, the protection for anyone else is the stuff they should be doing all along in any healthcare setting. We've been teaching them how to do it. We've been teaching emergency medical providers and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The people that would ordinarily be in these situations have gotten a pretty high level of instruction and are generally moving to take good precautions. It's the relatively unusual situation that is very hard to define. I really respect the problem of the physician here, of how you write it down, because it is so relatively unusual where you might want that test. The test in and of itself isn't any protection. All the test does is tell you a little bit earlier than you might know otherwise, I might be going to get HIV positive myself. That's all having that test done will tell you. It's still, if that HIV test is negative, you can take a sigh of relief 3 months earlier than you could otherwise. If the test is positive on the person you were exposed to, you're still going to have to wait the 3 months and be tested at intervals to see whether you seroconvert. And in either case, we haven't got any magic treatment to offer you to make a difference.
Mr. Chairman, can I make a try at accommodating these various interests? I think it's important to keep in some notion of informed consent, because I've been hearing the phrase now, the three C's, consent, confidentiality, and counseling, as really being the key to having any sort of relationship of trust in the management, healthcare management of people who are HIV infected. A way to accomplish this might be to keep the language that we have now. No person shall subject the blood of an individual to an HIV test without first obtaining informed consent. Put back in the exceptions that were in the amendments that this committee passed on April 22, and then to accommodate Mr. Gallant's, I think, legitimate concern that this could be creating unintended liability for
for physicians or other people, we could put into the immunity clause that no person will be held liable, and this is not the exact language, no person will be held liable for a decision not to obtain informed consent. And, that sort of immunity would be standard in an emergency situation. I mean, in an emergency, you have to decide that you're going to do certain things without the person's consent, and there would be a certain degree of immunity for a physician making a decision under those sort of circumstances. And so I think you could immunize the person from liability so that they would not be responsible for having to make a correct determination about whether there was or was not a serious threat to a third person. And that would, I think, preserve the core notion of getting informed consent in the vast majority of instances. It would allow exceptions, but it wouldn't create any liability for a person's decision to act on the basis of one of those exceptions.
Mr. Chairman, I hate finding it to go back through circumstance that a number of us have debated and argued for hours and try to make a determination where I thought at least I had gotten to where I am today, and try to say that I'm going to possibly agree to that at this stage. But that aside, as a practical matter, physicians cannot do procedures without consent of individuals. We cannot provide surgery to an individual without their consent, or tests either. And, you know.